Now then, this is found in two places in the Old Testament. We'll look at it in Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapters 34 and 35. And each of these two accounts gives some details, not found in the other, of course. How old was he when he became king? Now, how old he was when he became king? 8 years old. All right, is that the youngest? Is that the first championship award for youthful kingship? Who was younger than that? Joash, the one who was hidden in the temple 6 years from his murderous grandmother, you remember? That was Joash. He became king at the age of 7. This one is only the runner-up, winning the second prize. Became king at the age of 8. Now, please note, he had a bad background. If heredity and early influences affect a person, his father was Amon and his grandfather was Manasseh, and this was a bad start in life. When he became king, things were pretty well, let's say, gone wrong. Even though Manasseh had repented before he died, you see, his son Amon took over and undid a lot of the good again. So there was a lot that needed to be done to be straightened out. Now, 8 years old, a Jewish boy became legally of age at the age of 12. Even that is pretty young. We don't have many Geneva students that are as young as that. I mean, it's their real age. And I would like to spend the time today to try to put out to you two propositions. In the first place, Josiah was a reformer in the best sense of the term. And secondly, what was this book that was discovered, and what reasons are there for believing it to be the genuine writing of Moses? Now, in the first place, Josiah, a reformer, and not a fanatic. What is a fanatic? Well, All right, is there such a thing as a religious fanatic? Well, I'll give you one sample. A religious fanatic can only talk on one subject. He's hipped on some one idea, and maybe it's that the moon is made of green cheese or something like this, but he won't talk on anything else. Did you know that the moon is made of green cheese? Did you ever hear that? Well, I heard this discussed at a baccalaureate of the Beaver Falls Senior High School by the former pastor of the Christian Missionary Alliance Church, Mr. Henry. And he said there was a young fellow went to college, and his mother said, "Son, the Word of God has the answers. I'm putting a Bible in your suitcase." And this lad wasn't quite bright, you know. He really wasn't college material, but he went to college. And when he got there, the sophomores started to haze him. And some of them got a hold of him and said, "Say, did you know that the moon is made of green cheese?" "No, I didn't know that." "Is it? Really?" "Yeah, science has proved it. Now you go to the library and look it up and come back and tell us, this is your assignment, you come back and tell us what science has proved about whether the moon is made of green cheese." So this lad goes to the library and asks the librarian, "You got any books in this library on whether the moon is made of green cheese?" And she looked at him thinking, "Well, where did you get out from?" He didn't get any place with that. And then he remembered his mother had said, "The Word of God has the answer." So he went to his room and started reading the Bible, Genesis chapter 1. "Ah, that's it." He went back to the sophomore and says, "I know the answer." "Well, is it made of green cheese?" "No, it isn't and it couldn't be." "How do you know?" "Well, the moon was made on the fourth day, and the cows and goats that we get milk from to make the green cheese were made on the sixth day." So the moon couldn't be made of green cheese. Now, anybody that goes around crusading for a flat earth is a religious fanatic. One difference between a fanatic and a reformer is both of them have a zeal for a cause, but the fanatic doesn't have wisdom in how he goes about it. He will in the first place, try to do everything at once instead of sorting his issues and concentrating on the most important one. He'll try to do everything at once. And he will act in a hasty way without proper preparation, and of course it will flop and not succeed. Now, I'll give you an example from American history of a great man who still failed because of a lack of proper preparation. Maybe he couldn't help it, but how many of you have been at Harper's Ferry? You've been there? Was it a pretty place? Did you admire the scenery?
Was it
pretty? Harper's Ferry? On the upper Potomac, where the states of Maryland, West Virginia, and Virginia approximately meet. I want to tell you, Harper's Ferry is a nice place for a date. You can go and spend about 3 hours there on a picnic and get back before the Victorian deadline in McKee and Pierce Falls. Now, at Harper's Ferry, before the Civil War, there was an arsenal that made artillery for the U.S. Army. And there was a Kansas farmer named John Brown. John Brown was not a black man, he was a white man, but he had a burning zeal against the awful injustice of slavery. This was a drive of his life to do something about that, for which he should always be honored, of course. 5 grown sons and John Brown, and a burning zeal against slavery before the Civil War. And John Brown and about 20 other people that he had signed up to go with him went to Harper's Ferry, and of all things, they succeeded in capturing the U.S. arsenal and holding it for about 3 days. In the course of this, there was a shooting affray with the few soldiers that were there. 3, I believe, of Brown's sons were killed. A black man that worked for the railroad, who was no slave but a free citizen, was killed in the crossfire. He had nothing to do with it, but he lost his life in this. And John Brown himself was captured alive and tried for treason, I believe, and hanged. Now, I doubt very much that John Brown would be hanged today. I doubt if any jury would vote to do this, but he was then. Now, this man had a burning zeal for a cause, but you see, this lacked wisdom. How could this be expected to succeed? Just a little handful of men going to fight the United States government. Now, it took a lot more than that to get slavery abolished in this country. And John Brown did what he could, but this was, I think we would have to rate this as well-intentioned, sincere, but fanatical in that it lacked wisdom. Confucius said, a student who attends class most frequently usually does well on final exams. Confucius said, to run a country, I would choose a man who will not, when unarmed, attempt to fight a tiger or try to get an army across the river at a point where there is no bridge. In other words, he's got to act sensibly, he's got to make plans, he's got to carry them out in a wise and intelligent way. Now, apply this to Josiah. He sees just about everything gone wrong in the country, and he wants to do something about it, but he doesn't do anything about it hastily, and he doesn't do anything foolish. He acts wisely and deliberately. First of all, he becomes king at 8, and for several years doesn't do anything that is official. I suppose he ate and so forth, but as king. When he was 16, after being king technically, for 8 years, he experienced a religious awakening. Now, this is certainly what we would call today a conversion experience. And let me point out, this pattern of becoming aware of God in your middle teens is not limited to Christianity. This is found in all religions. It's evidently a part of the human adolescent psychology. But, of course, in the true religion, this is coupled up with the real renewing work of the Holy Spirit so that the person really gets saved and becomes a new creature in Christ. Whereas in a religion like Hinduism, it has only the human psychological side to it. Young people and children who have been raised in a godly home and taught by parents and teachers about God and Christ and the way of salvation usually believe this. And yet, it may not be real to them personally. may not be personally vital, but to hear 16 years old, somewhere along there, 13, 14, 15, 16, the young people become acutely aware of themselves as persons and aware of their need of or lack of or possession of a relationship to God. This is part of the pattern of Christian religious psychology. So here's Josiah, age of 16. He comes to know God not merely by a traditional faith handed down by parents and teachers and so on, pastors, but in his personal life. And if you haven't got this, you're a dealer in secondhand religion. Better than none, but isn't good firsthand. Now, still he doesn't do anything rash until he's 20 and has been king 12 years. A Jewish boy was rated of age at 12. He's 20 now. And at this point, he goes about reforming the kingdom. Now, notice he goes out to do it personally. He doesn't simply send people to do it. He goes out there to see to it that it's done right. And the altars and high places and images of the sex, fertility, and nature cult of Canaan that were all over the place again are once more removed. There's two parts to reforming religion, just like there's two parts to electricity, positive and negative. You have to do something first about the false, and that's the negative part, and then you can't leave it at that. You have to replace this and meet the need with something that's true. So first he deals with the false worship, the altars, the Baal images, and all this business. And in doing this, he took a personal interest in it, and besides this, he thought of a gimmick that nobody had ever thought of before, apparently. He dug up the dead and buried remains of some of the idolatrous priests that had serviced these pagan altars, and burned them on the altars and sprinkled the lime and ashes around the place, thereby contaminating them more or less permanently in the Jewish way of looking at things. Now, to understand this, you have to realize the Jewish taboo about contact with death. Nobody can permanently avoid contact with death. Some member of your family dies, their body has to be buried, and you can't avoid touching them. But according to the law of Moses, which is the law of God given by Moses, every contact with death carried a technical contamination. A farmer is plowing a field and quite unintentionally and surprised himself, turns up some human bones of somebody maybe that had lived long before. If he touches one of those, he's technically contaminated for a period of days. A student in a medical school who touches a skeleton in a glass case may be cleaner than lots of live people. Doesn't make any difference. He's technically contaminated for a period of time. And this person has to avoid contact with other people until the time limit is up. Then he has to take a bath and wash all his clothes. And after that, he's fit to associate with society again. This is the idea. Now, this has nothing to do with cleanness and dirtiness. I'm sure there are bones and dead bodies that are cleaner than some white people. I baptized two or three people once in China that looked to me like they'd never had a bath in their life. Now, I suppose they must have, but they looked like they'd never had one. And it's crowded and cold, and everybody's sort of huddling in together in the wintertime, and it's hard to keep clean. I told this to a Baptist missionary friend, and he said, "That's your fault for being a Presbyterian. If they'd just be Baptists, they'd get at least one good bath in their life." Now, that was that. Josiah capitalizes on this idea. Please note, the practice of a thing like this as a custom can linger on long after the ideology involved in it is forgotten. Now, this taboo about death, I think we should realize what's back of this. This can be figured out, and I think it could be substantiated pretty well from the early books of the Old Testament. Death is the consequence of sin. The day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. By one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Romans chapter 5. Now, Death is the consequence of sin, and if somebody is not a Christian, death is the penalty of sin. If you are a Christian, there cannot be a penalty because Christ bore it, but so it's a consequence. It's God's way of getting you to a better life. And nobody can avoid contact with death permanently. Everybody comes in contact with it among their relatives and so forth at some time. And this was to remind people by an experience that nobody could avoid, that we are members of a sinful and fallen race and need salvation. We need to be saved by the saving grace of God. And this would remind people over and over, you know, we tend to get self-righteous and think we're pretty good. Remind people that we are sinners and we need salvation. Anybody remember hearing Dr. Rayburn when he spoke here and spoke in some of the churches and also in the college here from St. Louis? He told about a woman in a church where he was preaching and conducting evangelistic services, and she came and spoke to him at the end of the service and said, "Dr. Rayburn, the Lord really didn't have to change very much when he saved me." But she said, and he said, "You know, that woman was the worst troublemaker, bar none, in the church that she was a member of." And she said, "The Lord didn't have to change very much when he saved me." Well, it's nice to have a good opinion of yourself if it's really true. Now, the theology in this would be forgotten, and yet the practice would linger on. Touch human ashes or human bones, the Jew would recoil from this in horror. They would feel about this like you would feel if somebody would suggest eating a rat. You wouldn't do it unless you were just absolutely starved to death. They would recoil in horror from this. I can give you other examples of customs that linger on after the theology is forgotten. Easter, named after the Anglo-Saxon goddess of springtime, Eostre, E-O-S-T-R-E. And our ancestors used to worship her. And springtime, you know, everybody's in favor of it. Everything comes back to life after the long, drab, dead, cold winter. And so this is how the springtime festival of Eostre, the goddess of springtime, has the baby chicken bunny rabbit angle in it. Now, when our ancestors became Christians, they quit worshiping the goddess of springtime and began to worship Jesus Christ. But they celebrated the resurrection of Christ, but they still kept the name Easter, which goes back to pagan, Anglo-Saxon, and Nordic, North European worship of the goddess of springtime. Now, Geneva College, didn't sponsor it, but it was on college property, had an Easter egg hunt here a few days ago at the 33rd Street ball field. And some of the youngest members of the community picked up in just practically no time flat over 3,000 painted and colored eggs. Does this mean Geneva College believes in Eostre, the goddess of springtime? Well, I think not. And this ideology has long been forgotten, but you see the name and some of the practices linger on in this way. Now, we're going to have May Day. Are they going to have a May pole and a May dance?
Yes.
They are. The last time. Ah. Well, Josiah's been around here. I had nothing to do with it, but there has been objection raised to it, I understand, by some. On the ground that this May pole and May dance is a continuation of a sex and fertility rites of ancient Celtic origin, and that the ideology of it is objectionable from the standpoint of a Christian college. Now, I always attend the May Day program for two reasons. In the first place, it's free. In the second place, it's always a nanny good show. And these are two good reasons. But I wonder whether the original ideology and symbolism of this hasn't been completely forgotten. That this does not suggest to people's minds today what it did once, long ago, at the time when our remote ancestors first became Christianized. Well, this is not in my province. One thing you learn in this college is to mind your own business, so I will not pronounce further on May Day. But Josiah has the altars deliberately contaminated in this way. This would cause any Jew who had the least shred of Jewish feeling left in his blood to leave him alone. Horrors, no. Worship at an altar where there's human ashes sprinkled on it, I'd rather die. So they wouldn't do it. Now, he also had the Passover restored, and this was done with great unanimity, and he had the temple repaired. Who built this temple and how old was it? You know, Mr. Thompson? Well, it couldn't be that many years, but Solomon built it. He lived in the 900s, early in the 900s. And here we are late in the 600s. So this temple is, let's say, roughly 350 years old. You would expect a building that old just from normal use to be pretty badly in need of some repairs and renovations. Now, Old Main here is about 100 years old, and you come back in 250 more years and see what it looks like. Right now, the men's lounge, so-called, in the basement, the decor down there, reminds me strongly of the county jail. Now, it's nice to have it anyhow, you know, but this building is to be extensively remodeled and completely refitted and turned into small classrooms and offices, and we're going to have a new, air-conditioned, strictly modern classroom building across the street somewhere. Yeah, Miss Mercury. Well, I'll tell you, Miss Mercury, I don't think it's going to happen in my time, and I doubt whether it'll happen in your time. I think it's in phase 17 or something like this. So I wouldn't worry about it. I don't think it's going to happen right away for quite a while. Now, apart from the fact that the temple would need a facelifting just because of age, it had been closed up and out of use under Ahaz and virtually out of use under some of these other kings like Manasseh for a long time, and therefore it was in bad need of some work done on it extensively. And Josiah recognized this. He had a fund raised and people made contributions and voluntarily, and enough money was raised to do it, and workmen were employed to renovate the temple, and the job was done. And in the course of this, a book was found, described as a book of the law of the Lord given by Moses. Now, on the face of it, that would mean the first five books of the Bible, or some part of the first five books of the Bible, but the genuine writing of Moses. This book in Josiah's time sparked a real religious revival. In our own time, it has sparked a real religious controversy. In Josiah's day, revival, and today, controversy as to what this book was and how it came to be found there. Now, the continental divide of opinions about this is whether this book was the genuine writing of Moses or not. And we will take up the positive view first, that it really was the genuine writing of Moses, and then take up the negative view, which is widely held today. Now, this may have been the book of Deuteronomy, or it may have been Exodus, or it might even have been the whole five books, although that is perhaps unlikely because it was read in the presence of the king later, and it would have taken an awful long time to read the whole five books through. Very possibly just the book of Deuteronomy. Anyhow, the question is raised, if this was really the writing of Moses, how come it was found in the temple? And three possible answers are given to this. The first place, it had simply been lost. You realize most people couldn't read and write. The copies were handwritten. The king was supposed to have one. The high priest was supposed to have one. And there might have been one more at any one time, or two perhaps. And that's it. When this was discovered, it was treated not simply as the discovery of a Bible, but as the recovery of the Bible. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in the loft above the chapel. Put on your old dirty clothes as you go up there. Well, that's a jungle of wires and dust and old furniture and stuff, and they have pictures and frames of Geneva's baseball and football teams of the 1880s and 90s up there. If you think that people or men are going around campus with pretty long hair and whiskers and beards today, you ought to see those pictures from about 1895. Somebody got them down once and sung them all around the classrooms of this building upside down. A very subtle sense of academic humor. Suppose somebody would get up there and find an old Bible dated 1795. This might make a little news item in the paper, Antique Bible Discovered in Loft Above Geneva Chapel. But it wouldn't cause a religious revival or revolutionize our religious life, because why, we've got lots of Bibles. But you see, this was treated as if it was the recovery of the only known copy. That's something about this. Now then, first supposition, that it had been lost. The second, it had been deliberately hidden there by some of the good priests during the time of Ahaz or Manasseh or one or another of the bad kings, hidden for safekeeping against a king who would destroy it if he could. This is possible. The third theory, in my opinion, the most plausible of all, that it was placed in a cornerstone at the time when the temple was originally built by Solomon in the 900s. Now, this practice of putting objects in a cornerstone of a structure, especially a temple, was extremely ancient. This has been found in lower Mesopotamia from early the Chaldees and other places there from before the time of Abraham, more than 4,000 years ago. Things put in the cornerstone. When the Mycenae field house was starting to be built, which the town radio called the Methany field house, they had a ceremony down there to lay a cornerstone. It was a real mud hole down there before the building was built, and set up a big wooden platform and covered it with red and white and blue bunting. And here was the mayor of Beaver Falls and the mayor of New Brighton and the Congressman Frank Clark and President Clark of our college, of course, and other dignitaries. And they had a place there with the music provided and speeches made, and laid this cornerstone for the Mycenae Fieldhouse. And they put things in it. And they asked me, as head of the Bible department, to provide a Bible to go in that cornerstone. And I figured, nobody's ever going to see it. I'm sure not going to put a $20 one in there. So I went down to the bookstore and said, how much are your cheapest Bibles? Well, they finally talked me into going as much as $2.25 for one. So I charged it to the budget of the Bible department and got a $2.25 Bible. And it went in there, and along with this, the flag of the United States, the U.S. Constitution, the Geneva College catalog, the student newspaper, the cabinet, the Times magazine of the English department, the Beaver Falls News Tribune, the Beaver County Times, and a number of other items, and this Bible. And then it was all sealed up. It was made of bronze or copper and sealed up and put there and cemented in with mortar into the wall. As soon as the crowd was gone, the contractor yanked it out again. So we're not near ready to put this cornerstone in here. So it got put back later. It's there. If some archaeologist comes around after 1,000 years and digs the place up, he'll find out what kind of a college this was when he finds in that cornerstone. Now, don't any of you try it. There's no money in it. I'll guarantee you, it's just a cheap Bible. But this is an ancient practice, and it is very possible, but not proven, of course, that the Book of the Law had been hidden in this cornerstone at the time when the temple was built. Now they're repairing the temple because of damage, and the workmen come across this book. Now there's three possibilities as to how it came to be there. They gave the book to Hilkiah, the high priest. He recognized it for what it was and took it to the king. He had it read in his presence, and before it was clear through reading it, he set up and rent his robe, a sign of distress or grief. And they had a woman prophet at this time. Her name was Huldah. I never knew a girl named Huldah, although I'd known a plain named Hilda. But Huldah, her husband had the job of looking after the priest's garments, the wardrobe at the temple, a full-time busy job. And she was his wife and had the gift of prophecy, even, but she did. And it says there she lived in Jerusalem with her husband in the college. That's the King James Version, in the college. I asked one class, what kind of college was this? And a student said, Covenantic College, of course. Now, this should be translated in the Geneva Arms, or other name of an apartment house. It doesn't mean a college. Anyhow, they sent to Huldah to ask her what the will of God was. You see, this book gave many commandments of God, and Josiah recognized we have neglected many of these. And so he was concerned and sent to Huldah, and she said, the will of God is that judgment is coming, and it's going to be trouble and bad because of the sins of this kingdom. But
because Josiah was concerned about this and showed his grief about it and tore his robe, God promises him that the trouble will not come during his lifetime, but only after he is dead. Now, this discovery of the book, it was later read to the people in a big mass meeting. The Passover was restored. The Word of God was again given its rightful place in the nation, and there was a considerable revival. It was not permanent, but it lasted quite a while, of turning back to God. Now, on the other view, that this book was not the genuine writing of Moses, this is a mere hypothesis, for my money, cannot stand, but you ought to know about it, because you can't walk around in the religious world of today without bumping into this. There are people, it's widely held, and it's held in more than one form, but I'll give you the simplest form. We won't bother our heads with the more complicated one. The simplest form of this is that this book was not the genuine writing of Moses, but written by other people, and it was not an old book at all. It was only recently written, and you could say, in a way, the ink was hardly dry on it. And the theory is, you understand this is pure speculative theory, the theory is that a group of religious priests at the temple got all concerned and troubled at the worship of the pagan altars on the high places. And they said, we'll never get this right like it ought to be till we get religion centralized right here in Jerusalem where we can keep our eye on it and have it under our own control. How are you going to do that? It's been tried and tried and tried. These high places of king after king has tried to clear them away. They always come back. This Canaanite cult is ancient and popular and deeply embedded in the thinking of the people. How are you ever going to get them to give this up? Well, if we'd put out a manifesto and sign our own names to it, it wouldn't have any effect. This kind of thing's been tried before. It didn't work. But the name of Moses carries some weight. So if we would put out a book as if it were written by Moses and put the name of Moses in it a whole lot of places, and besides this, in this book, strongly emphasize the single sanctuary idea that God is to be worshipped with blood sacrifices in one place only. Now, it won't do to say in Jerusalem, because in Moses' day, our people didn't have Jerusalem yet. But let's say in the place where God is going to put his name, that'll do, and strongly emphasize this, and then hide this book so it will be found apparently accidentally, and the common people will take this to be the genuine writing of Moses, and we will be able in this way to sell this reform to the people on the weight of the name of Moses. So the theory is they did this and wrote this book, ghost wrote it for Moses and got it finished and put it in the temple, and covered it up with some of the trash, but not so deep but what it would be sure to be found when the temple was cleaned and repaired. And so it was found, and was taken by the people and even by the king to be the genuine writing of Moses, but it wasn't really. And that this book was the book of Deuteronomy. Now, that means, of course, in plain Beaver Valley English, that the book of Deuteronomy is not genuine, that it's a forgery. A student said, what difference does that make? We have the book in our Bible and can get the religious benefit of it just the same. Now, let me ask you, is a counterfeit $20 bill as good as a genuine $20 bill? How about Mr. Winger? Is it?
No.
It isn't. As long as you still think it's genuine, it can give you that comfortable feeling of not being broke. Is that right? You think it's genuine. But in the end, it's without value. Now, please note, there's been three, I believe, warnings on the radio recently in the Beaver Valley here to watch out about counterfeit $20 bills. Somebody is using this area to pass them out. And so be careful what you accept as change for something. All right, if the book of Deuteronomy is really a forgery, it cannot be part of the inspired Word of God. It cannot be what it seems to be and what it claims to be, but is in plain language a fake. And God doesn't use this kind of thing to accomplish his spiritual purpose in the world. Now, I'll give you two criticisms for this modern theory about Deuteronomy. The first is psychological. This involves a built-in psychological contradiction. It represents these priests that are said to have done this, as so concerned about truth that they're willing to tell some lies to promote it. Now, does that make sense? Priests who are so up in the air about opposition to false religion and eager to promote true religion that they're willing to tell a lie to promote it. That's what this amounts to. This doesn't make sense. People who really believe in truth tell the truth. They don't deal in falsehood. So that's the first difficulty. The second is of a pragmatic nature, the extreme difficulty of ghostwriting a book for somebody and getting away with it. Now, I wonder, do you think, any of you, that you could write a letter as if by George Washington and sign his signature to it and have it pass the expert? Make you sure, Mr. Chu? I heard of a kid in grade school had to write a letter like some famous person in history would write it, and this is what this fellow about the fourth grade wrote, Napoleon Bonaparte. Dear Josephine, I didn't do so well at Waterloo. Lots of love, Nappy. Now, I'm not sure he got away with that even in fourth grade, but certainly wouldn't fool the expert. Even though Josephine was the name of his lady love at that particular time, that one for that little time, and the Empress. Now, Moses lived, if you hold the early chronology, 800 years before Josiah. If you hold the late chronology, all right, 650 years before Josiah. Is it possible to ghostwrite a book and get away with it? I'll tell you an experience or two. The Times magazine, gotten out by the English department. I always buy it and want to see what my students are writing, and some of it's very good. But several years back, it had a story in that won a prize, and it was called The Girl in the Mint Green Bathing Suit. And this hadn't been for sale, you know, on campus here for half a day before the English department began getting phone calls. Some of them from students and some of them from professors that they'd read this story before. And where had they read it? In the Saturday Evening Post. And it had been slightly shortened and the title very slightly altered, but demonstrably any jury in the world would have said it was cribbed out of the Saturday Evening Post. They could have sued our college for violating their copyright. We were careful not to tell them about it. This guy didn't get away with it. He claimed, however, that it wasn't his fault. He had written something for the English department, laid it on the kitchen table, and it got mixed up with something his brother had written for high school and got into the Times by mistake. That's what he claimed. Now, another one, Dr. Norman Carson, head of the English department, about 6 years ago, said a young lady in one of his classes handed in a theme that didn't read to him like any Geneva student could have written it. And he's pretty sharp, you know. He went down to the Carnegie Library downtown and said, I want to see all the copies of Mademoiselle and 17 for the last 6 years. So the librarian brought him out, a stack like that. And he started going through them and got halfway through, and here was this theme in one of those magazines. So when the next class came around, he asked this sweet young thing to stop after class. And she came around and said, I suppose you know what I want to see you about. Yes. What did you do it for? I got in a jam. And he was so sorry for her, he told her, you understand, I'm not allowed to accept this according to the rules. You'll have to write another one, and she agreed to do it. He was merciful to it. Now, you know, you can't fool Dr. Norman Carson. And I want to tell you a story. Now, this really happened. It was in the Reader's Digest, and it was in a book published in New York, and it happened about 1951 or 52. A book was published in New York of Adventures from World War II by a man that lived in Western Canada, Winnipeg or that area. And an amazing adventure story. He claimed to have been in the British Royal Air Force and parachuted into German-occupied France, latter part of World War II, and had conducted a one-man war of sabotage against the Germans. He had bombed locomotives, destroyed tunnels, blown up shipyards, bombed factories, and you name it. He'd done it, and always with the secret police a jump or two behind him, practically breathing down his neck. And he always got away with it to do it again.
And this was published in New York, and the Reader's Digest paid a good hard money and lots of it to get the right to publish a condensation of it as a book supplement in the Reader's Digest. So this guy was having quite a financial success with this, the story that he put out. And then the Mounties called on him. Canadian Royal Mounted Police. Now, you know the saying is the Mounties get their men. They don't ride horseback anymore except for dress parade. They drive cars, and the Mounties are the Canadian equivalent of the FBI, but they are an elite group. There's no rough stuff in the Mounties. They're gentlemen. Two officers of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police called on this star, and he's got a menu. They didn't threaten him or browbeat him or anything. They just asked him questions. Now, you know, if you're telling the truth, you can answer questions till the end of the world. But if you're telling lies, you got to watch out. It's not the first cost on a lie that counts. It's the upkeep on it. And the more questions they asked him, the worse he got mixed up. And finally, he said, well, officer, I guess I might as well tell you the truth. And this officer said, well, that'd be constructive. So he said, officer, the truth is, I was never in France in my life. I was in England. The war came to an end. I would have been sent to France, but the war ended. I was sent back to Canada and soon after discharged from military service, and the whole thing is a made-up story. Why did you do it? Well, I was invited by the Boy Scouts to tell about my experiences in the war. Officer, you know my experiences in the war weren't very thrilling. They were chiefly KP. I peeled potatoes, I shined officers' shoes, I picked up cigarette butts, I washed dishes, and I didn't think this would do to tell to the Boy Scouts, so I added a few little items to it. And it went over big. I tell you, the Boy Scouts are an appreciative audience. And so then I was invited to speak to the Lions Club, and then the Rotary Club, and so forth. The Business and Professional Women's Club, out of which he got, I believe, $125 that night. And every time, he must have been a dandy storyteller, every time he told this, he added a little to it and told it a little more convincing.